Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Anne Ozerjan, Principal Clinical Psychologist at Evelina London Children's Hospital, Guy's and St Thomas's NHS Foundation Trust. Anne's clinical and research interests include assessment and treatment of mental health difficulties and autism spectrum disorder. Anne will be giving a series of ACAM masterclasses on this subject. Anne, thanks for joining me. Can you start with an introduction about who you are and what you do?
Hi, yes, I'm a principal clinical psychologist at the Evelina London Children's Hospital and also in independent practice. Part of my role involves complex assessment of neurodevelopmental difficulties, and a large proportion of the children that we see have difficulties on the autism spectrum. Another large part of the work I do involves providing specialist interventions for children and young people on the autism spectrum who experience a range of emotional, behavioural and mental health problems. Within this, my particular interest is in anxiety and in the treatment and assessment of mental health difficulties in general in autism spectrum disorder.
And what factors in your own background and training prompted your interest in this field?
Well, prior to clinical training, my first job in the field was as an assistant psychologist at the Michael Rutter Centre with Professor Emily Simonoff, which was an inspirational start to my career. That was where I first became interested in autism spectrum disorder, or autism spectrum conditions, as some people prefer to call it. I then trained at Oxford, and my training there had a strong focus on cognitive behaviour therapy. So when I moved into my current post, which I've held for the past 16 years in various shapes and forms, for me there was a kind of natural coming together of therapeutic skills and a specialism in autism, which coincided with an interest internationally, really, in developing specialist adapted interventions for people with autism spectrum disorder who are also experiencing mental health problems. There was a sort of collective interest among researchers and clinicians around the world, really, at this time, in recognising and meeting the mental health needs in people with autism spectrum disorder, which until then were really quite neglected.
Your focus, as you've said, is on mental health problems in children and young people with ASD. What is the prevalence of mental health difficulties in this group?
So this can vary quite a lot between studies, and the identification of mental health problems in autism spectrum disorder can be fraught with methodological problems. For example, how do you unpick mental health symptomatology from autism spectrum type presentations and other mental health problems? Do they present in the same way as they do in the general population? And if so, are we measuring what we think we're measuring? But leaving that aside for just a moment, we probably have the best prevalence data on anxiety. And there's reasonable consensus between the majority of studies, including meta-analyses, showing that current prevalence rates of anxiety occurs at a rate of about 40 to 50% in people with autism spectrum disorder. And lifetime prevalence rates are even higher, i.e. the chance that you may experience anxiety at some point. And this is way higher than the general population, where anxiety tends to occur at a rate of around 2 to 10%.
It's a huge difference.
Huge difference, yeah. And we're also beginning to gather better data on the prevalence rates of depression and also suicidal ideation and behaviour, both of which also occur at higher rates than in the general population.
What factors might predispose young people with ASD to problems such as anxiety or depression?
Again, this is an area which recently has received a good deal of research attention. So what is it about autism spectrum disorder that predisposes people to such high rates of anxiety and depression? And people have looked at a variety of things, including cognitive factors. So whether there are certain cognitive styles that can predispose individuals to anxiety or depression. So, for example, resistance to change or a desire for sameness is one of the hallmark features of ASD. And this has led researchers in Newcastle, to name one group, to investigate intolerance of uncertainty, which is a kind of style which has been investigated in a number of other difficulties. And indeed, it's been shown to play a significant role in the development of anxiety in ASD. Difficulties with emotion identification and expression, collectively known as alexithymia, have also been shown to play a role. And my colleague Seb Gaig is a leader in this field as well. Also, people have thought about sensory sensitivities, which can create difficulties, because the world can be a really overwhelming place, for example, if you have sensory hypersensitivity or indeed hyposensitivity to sounds, noises, smells, crowds, etc. And there's also been a fair amount of work looking at physiological and anatomical differences between brains of people with anxiety and autism, those without. So I'm not in any way a psychiatrist or neurologist, but there's pretty good evidence that there are some functional abnormalities in the way the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex communicate with each other. So that is the bit of the brain which really generates emotions, and then the bit of the brain which kind of helps us organise our emotional responses to things. So there may be some differences there. But as well as these factors, there may be very valid ecological reasons why people with ASD may be more prone to anxiety or depression. For example, some of the social, organisational or sensory demands of school or indeed work can be overwhelming, even for the very academically able. So many young people experience social isolation or bullying. And recently, a lot of attention has also been given to camouflaging or masking, which means basically hiding one's feelings or adapting one's behaviour to, inverted commas, fit in, inverted commas. And there is a recognition that this in itself can be exhausting, and that there's an emotional toll to this exhaustion also. So I think we really need to focus on protective factors and think about how we can improve the lives, really, of people with autism in order to reduce the risk of mental health problems. Mm-hmm. For example, facilitating friendships and social contact, reducing social isolation, increasing a sense of self-efficacy and success at school and in the workplace. And a lot of these things can be addressed in the early years by getting education right. I think that's just absolutely essential. And there can also be a role for medication, of course, which can be transformative, although we really have to be careful that this isn't a substitute for other more appropriate interventions.
And whose responsibilities is that? Does that fall with schools, parents, government?
Well, that's a great question. Hopefully we'll address that a bit later on. But I think everybody's, in a sense. I mean, there's an emphasis now on services working together and agencies rather working together. It's not a perfect system by any means, but the philosophy is correct in that everyone has to work together and parents have to be a key stakeholder. Okay. So, for example, I mentioned medication just now. You know, every conversation we have about something like that involves parents and the young people, if they're able, in order to think about the best way forward.
We talked earlier about the high prevalence of mental health problems in children and young people with ASD, but this often goes untreated. Why is that, do you think?
So there could be a number of reasons for this. One is, as I mentioned, the problem of accurate identification or measurement of difficulties. And many people may struggle to articulate their difficulties. And parents often refer to a detective process when establishing the cause or nature of their children's difficulties. These difficulties may also present differently at home or at school. So with young children and children and young people often putting on a very brave face at school and kind of coping, whereas at home it can all fall apart when they're in a safe environment. And in that case, sometimes problems aren't seen as being pervasive across environments. And sometimes this can create difficulty in diagnosing or formulating difficulties. But of course, just because someone doesn't show anxiety overtly in one situation, it doesn't mean that they're not experiencing it. So as a result, many parents report asking for help, but not necessarily receiving it. Or worse, sometimes feeling blamed for their child's problems, as these appear to only occur at home. Another difficulty, of course, is that services are often overwhelmed or feel that they don't have the expertise. Although in the training that I provide, one of the key messages I try to get across to clinicians is that they don't have to work in a specialist setting to gain the confidence in working with people on the autism spectrum. I think seek training, seek supervision, network with colleagues and share case discussion, but often it's a matter of confidence, really. And one thing that seems to come out frequently from satisfaction surveys and also anecdotally in conversation with parents and young people is when they're talking about a positive experience with services, they often say, well, that person really got autism, or they really got me. So it's something about the connection and the understanding, really, which improves the services we deliver.
You sort of alluded to what I think is termed diagnostic overshadowing. Is that an issue? And if so, what can be done, and what is done, perhaps, to correctly identify mental health problems in this client group?
Yes, so diagnostic overshadowing refers to the phenomenon, really, of one diagnosis sort of trumping another. Mm-hmm. So in the case of autism and anxiety, well, if you have autism, anxiety is just an inevitable part of that. But increasingly, I think it's being recognised that not everyone with autism has mental health problems. And of those that do, they're not there all the time, i.e. these are separate treatable conditions. In terms of what's being done to correct this, there's been a lot of discussion. And now there's also some emerging work on the development of more appropriate assessment tools as well, based on qualitative and quantitative research as well, describing anxiety in autism spectrum, i.e. some of the similarities and differences. So this includes, for example, the anxiety scale for children called the ASC-ASD, which is based on the commonly used ARCADS anxiety measure. This has been developed by Jackie Rogers and colleagues in Newcastle. It includes some items specifically measuring things like worry around change, for example. So it's more specific to ASD.
I'm wondering, from the point of view of parents and teachers and non-health professionals, what are the telltale signs that relate to anxiety as a mental health problem as opposed to it being autism, or, in other words, what makes it over and above autistic behaviour?
So that's a really good question. And one of the early papers that we produced was based on focus groups with parents, and we asked them lots of questions about anxiety presentations. And throughout our focus groups, we asked them whether they were definitely talking about anxiety, not just autism. And parents were really, really clear, no, this is anxiety. So there was things like changes in the behavioural presentation of their child, things that maybe only a parent would notice. For example, one parent said things like, well, he gets a little bit skippy. Parents really commented on the difficulty that their young children had in terms of explaining what they were feeling anxious about. But they could just tell. So there are certain signs and symptoms, which some of which overlap with the general population, but some of which don't. So, for example, more social withdrawal. Well, actually, that could overlap with the general population as well. So it's quite difficult to kind of unpick those symptoms. But there are some specific things which might be different in the autism spectrum population. For example, an increase in routinised behaviour or a retreat into a special interest. These sorts of things might be signs and symptoms of anxiety. And it really takes someone who knows the child very well to be able to pick up on these differences.
I'm wondering about those children and young people who are missed out, where they don't get the diagnosis they need. What is the prognosis for a child with ASD who has mental health problems that go unidentified? What impact does this typically have on their lives and their prospects?
So I don't want to be too despondent or alarmist because of the large number of parents who do seek help and haven't necessarily been able to find it. Appropriate services or help because it's thin on the ground, really. And often parents are coping in extremely challenging situations. And we still have such a long way to go in terms of preventing mental health problems and crises by improving the environment, really, and experiences of people, young people with autism spectrum disorder. And it's so important to get schooling right, as I said. We really need to improve the experience of those people who are accessing services, both in terms of outpatient services, but also inpatient services, as these environments can be very challenging indeed for somebody with ASD.
Let's talk about the children who do get the help they need. Once a correct diagnosis has been made, what evidence-based interventions are available?
So the best available evidence we have currently for psychological interventions is for cognitive behaviour therapy with modifications tailored for ASD. A lot of the early studies used group interventions, leading to NICE guidelines, which came out in 2014, recommending group interventions and individual interventions if the child or young person finds group-based activities difficult. However, it's not always logistically easy to organise groups, and there's an increasing number of studies showing that individual intervention is just as effective, and certainly my clinical experience has indicated that as well. We've got data from about 80 cases from our clinic demonstrating positive effects on both quantitative measures and qualitative outcomes in terms of adaptive CBT. There's also a small but growing evidence base on other therapeutic approaches, including mindfulness, which has attracted a lot of attention, including mindful parenting when managing behaviour problems with children with developmental difficulties, including autism and ADHD, in fact, and also for young people with autism themselves. And this can be a particularly useful approach for those individuals who have difficulty identifying or expressing their emotions, or difficulty with the verbal interchange that's involved in cognitive behaviour therapy. I was also really excited at a recent conference to come across some emerging trials using dialectical behaviour therapy, schema focus therapy as well. So I think we're in the beginning of a really exciting phase of research into really tailoring individuals, interventions for individuals with autism. So thinking about what works for whom, rather than just taking interventions from a general population, making some adaptations and trialing these, although that was definitely a good place to start. Medication, of course, can also be life-changing and is widely used as an intervention. But we also do feel very strongly that this shouldn't be a substitute for more suitable alternatives. One should always look at environmental changes before medicating, but equally sometimes therapeutic interventions aren't possible until a certain level of regulation is achieved, and sometimes medication is the way forward with this.
Can you say something more about your own approaches using CBT and in particular mindfulness?
In terms of my main approaches, I do principally use or draw on cognitive behavioural techniques, which basically involves identifying unhelpful thinking and behavioural patterns and trying to modify these in order to improve emotional functioning. But these approaches aren't suitable for everyone. For example, people who have great difficulty communicating their inner thoughts. However, it's amazing what some people are capable of with a few adaptations. And one of the main adaptations would be to use a lot of visual supports. I find a whiteboard essential, for example. This can be really helpful in a number of ways. For example, in organising your thinking, and I refer to myself as well as the client in that respect. Also in terms of supporting thinking when language, communication can be difficult. And it also takes the pressure off in terms of making eye contact. So if you're both looking at a whiteboard rather than looking at each other, it just can make things a little bit easier sometimes. I've also had some training in dialectical behaviour therapy and schema focus therapy. I draw on these approaches when appropriate. If someone's not able to engage in verbal dialogue, I might just work through their parents using behavioural intervention, or just work on emotion regulation or psychoeducation, which can be sometimes enough, actually, just to help people understand what they're feeling and why can really make a big difference. And then a former colleague of mine also is very experienced in mindfulness, and we used to refer to each other, which was great. We had one patient in common who's given a marvellous interview on when he used mindfulness techniques and when he used CBT techniques. He's so articulate in describing what worked when. So.
Patients with ASD may struggle in unpredictable or unfamiliar settings. I'm wondering what you do prior to seeing a young patient for the first time to reduce these types of stressors.
Absolutely. So the service that I work in has a website, and also on my own website, we have lots of photographs of the environment and also an information section for young people so they know in advance where they're going and who they're going to meet. I also almost never see young people alone, certainly initially anyway, unless they request this. I reassure them that if they're reluctant to speak, that they don't have to. Quite frankly, I'd rather someone was in the room playing on their phone rather than not be in the room at all. Because often it's a matter of gaining trust. And sometimes if there's a conversation going on around them, people will join in their own time when they feel ready and comfortable to do so. So really it's about acceptance, being adaptive in your approach, not expecting too much initially, I think.
Anne, how can clinicians and other professionals who work with young people with ASD be better supported to both identify mental health problems and to treat these?
Unfortunately, I think it's the very common issue of funding. Funding, really. Funding for training, funding for supervision, funding for better collaboration and communication between services. I mean, you don't necessarily need funding for that, but equally it does help. There are moves in the right direction. For example, the replacement of educational statements with educational healthcare plans. Although this does involve healthcare agencies being much more involved in the EHC plans. And again, that involves time, that involves releasing people from clinic to be able to do that, and that just often isn't possible. The Children's IAPT initiative, though, also aims to train large numbers of mental health professionals in existing services with expertise in neurodevelopmental disorders and intellectual disability, including ASD. And there's good work going on around the country in terms of setting up these trainings. My colleague Mariana and I were involved in setting up one of the first ones, which gave us first-hand experience, really, of some of the challenges of developing services to meet the mental health needs of people with ASD. However, these training packages are in the early stages, really, and formal evaluation data aren't really available as yet.
What other key issues are important for practitioners?
Well, one key issue for practitioners might be mix up your caseload a bit. I think it's good to see a range of cases, even if you're the team specialist. It reminds ourselves of some of the challenges with people with ASD face, yeah. I think, if you kind of mix things up a bit in terms of your caseload. You probably also need to have some awareness of certain things about the ASD profile, although every individual is different, of course, but certain things, for example, it's important not to take things personally. For example, sarcastic or demand avoidant behaviour may come from a place of low self-esteem or fear of failure. Poor eye contact or a lack of warmth in the interaction might not be down to you and your poor engagement skills, but it might just be a difficulty of social communication or simply that the trust hasn't been established yet. Another thing I would say is never to make assumptions. Always ask questions, check things out, as the answers may surprise you. For example, one young person I worked with was really angry when I mentioned rewards. And it turned out when I asked him that he'd had a very aversive experience at school with a reward-based system, and he experienced it as really humiliating. Oh, so something that's normally considered a positive for him most definitely was not.
Where can practitioners go to educate themselves into the ASD profile?
They can come on our masterclass training courses. As I mentioned, the IAPT as well. Mm-hmm. That's much more longer term training. The National Autistic Society as well. Okay. Autistica, I think, are a fabulous resource base.
So there's lots of resources out there. What about parents? What are their key concerns?
So regarding parents, key matters that come up over and over again include seeking help for their child, but often feeling under scrutiny themselves, because of questions about their parenting style or their personal circumstances or their own anxiety. And I think it's really important to remember that parenting a child with autism can be extremely challenging and that we need to support parents. One of the other main concerns that we've mentioned already is a lack of appropriate or acceptable provisions. So parents often need support themselves, also in navigating the educational system as well. And health professionals can have a key role in this. So I think there's a number of ways in which we need to support parents better.
We've talked about funding. I'm wondering, are there any policy changes that you would like to see that would make a real difference for families affected by these issues that we've discussed?
In terms of policy changes, in an ideal world, I would love to see every local mental health service having high quality neurodevelopmental expertise available on site, preferably. Some CAMS teams have specialist neurodevelopmental teams within them or identified individuals who may have been trained, for example, as is the aim of CYP IAPT. I'd also like to see a recognition that education, i.e. getting the setting right, plays a huge role in the emotional well-being of young people with autism spectrum disorder. I've attended a number of tribunals and written countless reports for tribunals, and I think getting the setting right can often be life-changing. I'd also like to see, as I say, more support for parents themselves in terms of practical support, respite, for example, organising activities for young people, as many parents are managing in very high-risk situations with very little support.
Let's talk about research. Is there anything you're working on that you'd like to share?
Yes, in terms of research, my colleagues at the Evelina and I, and in fact beyond, have a particular interest in cognitive flexibility, with rigidity being a hallmark feature of autism spectrum disorder, and we're interested in the impact on both externalising and internalising difficulties of rigidity.
Mm. What else new is in the pipeline that excites you?
I think you touched on it earlier, in fact. I'm quite excited about taking a more holistic approach to mental health problems in autism. So as well as the therapeutic approaches and medication that we mentioned and education as well, I think we need to recognise the importance of a range of wellbeing activities. I mean, I'm thinking about things like special needs yoga, pets as therapy, outdoor activities, all those sorts of things, which I think, you know, should be part of a care plan, really. It's about improving overall wellbeing.
Right.
And not just focusing in on targeting on certain clinical features, I think. Last year as well, I got a small grant which enabled me to deliver mental health interventions within schools in collaboration with Garrett Park Advisory Service in Wandsworth. And I'd like to see more collaborations of this nature, really, between health and education and also the voluntary sector.
And finally, what are the key takeaways for parents and for professionals who may be listening to this podcast?
I would say that a key takeaway message is that mental health problems are treatable. We need more accurate identification of mental health problems in autism, and preferably prevention rather than cure by getting the environment right for people on the autism spectrum.
Brilliant, Anne, thank you ever so much. Dr. Anne Ozavidjian will be exploring some of these themes at the ACAM Autism Masterclasses. You can find more details on the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelt A-C-A-M-H.